Hello, and welcome to In the Kitchen with Brett Thorne. I'm your host, Brett Thorne, Senior Food and Beverage Editor of Nation's Restaurant News and Restaurant Hospitality. And today my guest is Francisco Migoya, the co-author of Modernist Bread and his most recent book, Modernist Pizza, which came out earlier this month. Both are sequels of sorts to Modernist Cuisine, the encyclopedia of new cooking techniques that sprung out of the molecular gastronomy movement of the mid-aughts. All of the Modernist Cuisine publications have been researched and published with the help of Nathan Myhrvold, the former Microsoft executive turned obsessive food science geek who invested his Microsoft fortune into food research. I met Myhrvold shortly before the original Modernist Cuisine book came out, when he was visiting journalists like me to promote it. Not only did he show up with his publicist and galleys of the encyclopedia, but with his 16-year-old son. That was perfectly fine, and the young man was very well behaved and not shy about contributing to the conversation, but it was the first and last time that anyone has brought one of their kids on a desk-side public relations visit. I would suggest that more people do that. Anyway, Myhrvold's visit added to my credibility with my mother because she was a big fan of Charlie Rose before he was canceled. Myhrvold had apparently gone from my office to Charlie Rose's and appeared on his late-night interview show. My mom emailed me and asked if I'd ever heard of Nathan Myhrvold, and I said he'd just been in my office, and she was thrilled that I was on the same interview circuit as Charlie Rose. However, unlike Charlie Rose, I haven't been accused of any sexual misconduct. So here I am, still in the media, conducting interviews. I actually met Francisco Migoya, today's guest, several years ago when Modernist Bread came out. He, too, visited my office and shared his fascinating observations about bread, and I've wanted to conduct a longer interview with him ever since, because he's a font of knowledge and a very nice guy. I always learn a lot when I speak with him, and I bet you will, too. So stay tuned, because here is Francisco Migoya. How are you, Francisco Migoya? It's nice to see you.
Pretty well. I mean, happy to have this massive project finished and accomplished and, starting our newer one. Actually, we've started our newest book a few months ago, so we waste no time here.
I guess not. So you wrote Modernist Bread a few years ago. You finished Modernist Pizza, and then what's...
Yes. We're working on, in the realm of baking, so not necessarily, so it'll be like baked goods, like croissants, brioche, cookies, pies, tarts, pound cakes, that sort of pastry, baked goods stuff. So not ice cream, not chocolates and confections, not plated desserts. So more in the realm of what you would find in like a bakery.
Right. Is it going to be called Modernist Baking?
I think so. We're not set on it yet, but we have to think about that. But tentatively, it's around those lines. So
I remember back when we spoke about Modernist Bread that you learned a lot of really interesting things about the bread baking process, but I forgot what they were. some of the things you learned about yeast and flour and all of that you didn't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's, there's many things that you go into a project with, like preconceived notions, if you will, of how things work and what is happening and so forth. But as you do research and you do experimentation and you test different things, you learn that perhaps you were wrong, or that the answer is longer than you thought it was, especially when it comes in the realm of like sourdough and fermentation and that sort of thing. It's a very complex world. So, I don't think you ever fully know everything there is to know about fermentation. I think it's one of those things that just you continuously learn about. So
what are some things, some preconceived notions, if you remember that far back, mm-hmm. About bread that you suddenly found or bread were not true?
Well, one of the biggest things was, the age of a sourdough starter, for example, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is something that is very romanticized, and it's, you know, people claim that their sourdough starter is 100 years old. You know, I had somebody that once gave me one that they claim was 400 years old. And, you know, first of all, how do you even know that? How is that even possible to prove, right?
Right.
Even one that is 50 years old. I mean, it's something that you have to take the person's word for it. But let's say it's true. Let's say that, yes, it was handed down from generation to generation. The problem with that is that whatever that sourdough starter was 100 years ago, there's nothing remotely even the same from the present one than there was from that one. So we attribute like all of this like sentimental attachments to it. Like, you know, there's some of my, you know, great, great grandmother's, you know, old country, you know, something's in there still. And the truth is that it's not, because just moving that sourdough starter from one place to the other, it already started to change. And you probably are not using the exact same flour. Most of the yeast and the lactic acid bacteria live in that flour. So unless you're able to procure the exact same flour that was used on that sourdough starter 100 years ago, it's going to change, because it's survival of the fittest. It's whatever bacteria is around is going to take over, and it's going to win. So the truth is that somebody who has a very strong, healthy, one-month-old sourdough starter can make really good bread with it. And so a lot of bakers are intimidated by that, right? They're like, well, my sourdough starter is not that old, so I don't know if I can even make good bread. And the answer is, you can absolutely make very good bread with a young sourdough starter. You don't need to have this ancient sourdough starter to make good bread. So that was one of them. The other was, this was a big one. And still people, you know, you give people facts and it doesn't seem to matter.
No.
It's the craziest thing. But we've proved beyond a doubt that eating whole wheat, whole grain breads is not healthier than eating white flour breads. The science doesn't back it up. And we've provided all of this like academic research on it. There's many papers that say it's inconclusive whether it's better for you or not. And you know, there's really just one paper that said, you know, eating whole grains is good for you. It's just one, and it's full of holes, and we show all the holes that are in that paper. But the story carries, right? The story carries on that, you know, that's the thing, you're supposed to eat whole grain, even if you don't like whole wheat bread. You're supposed to eat whole wheat bread. And that's something that is just not true.
So I think the idea behind that is that you're getting fiber if you're eating whole wheat bread, right?
That's fine, but that's not nutrition.
You're right.
It's not contributing nutrients. Right. It's not contributing vitamins. In fact, because of the nature of fiber, it's taking stuff away. It's like Drano for your body, right? And so that's, if you take it for that, for fiber, that's fine. But if you're taking it for nutrition, for contributing nutrition to you, like an apple would or an orange, that's the wrong approach.
How about in terms of calories? If fiber is taking up space, aren't those calories that you're not going to ingest, which a lot of us...
The calories and the starch. And, you know, if we're talking about low glycemic index versus high glycemic index, that is also a different story. But you can make a sourdough bread with white flour, and it has just as low glycemic index than a whole wheat flour bread does. A lot of it has to do with the fact that it's a sourdough bread. There are some studies that show that it has a lower glycemic index than, you know, just commercial yeast breads. And so they're theoretically better for you as far as, you know, being more slowly absorbed, so they're less fattening. People who have discomfort eating, you know, bread find that they can more easily digest sourdough breads. And, you know, there's, you know, it's interesting to me because people who, you know, have these problems with breads don't seem to have problem with pasta. You know, it's like it's either one or the other, right? But, typically if you have some sort of like allergy or sensitivity to flour, it's in every form, not just in bread form. So
that's interesting. Yeah, I wonder. Yeah. I mean, so much of what happens between us and food happens in our own brain and our own, you know.
Sure, sure. Yeah, and you know, celiac disease is real. That is absolutely real. I mean, there's no doubt that that is actually a thing. What is still up for debate is whether gluten sensitivity is in fact real or if it's all in our heads. And so we tend to think that it's not real, that there are other factors at play. It could be more what is like things that make you, foods that you eat that are, I don't want to use a very descriptive terms, but that maybe don't make you feel, it may make you feel bloated, right? And there's different foods that do that. It's not just bread. So if there's discomfort, it has, it's different mechanisms at play that have nothing to do with celiac disease.
So it might not be gluten. It could be any variety of other things going on.
Yes, right. And there's other proteins in bread too that people could be sensitive to. So.
Oh. Yeah, sure. Protein is complex and all foods have protein and it just kind of.
Correct.
Because proteins are what we use to build our cells, to build the structures and plants have cells and structure too, and they need protein for that. So, so now you have modernist pizza coming out. What were there other things you had to learn about pizza, which is, you know, bread with stuff on it?
Yeah. you know, there is an important distinction there because it was a natural segue to go from bread to pizza for us for a couple of reasons. The first was because, you know, it's both dough. I mean, we're talking about dough and fermented doughs. And we had a larger, initially we had a large enough section in our bread book on pizza. And as our book kept getting bigger and bigger, we had to find places to cut information out because it was going to be a 6-volume book, which, you know, 5 volumes sounds like a lot. 6 is really ridiculous. It increases shipping costs. It increases like all these things. So we definitely had to keep it at 5. So pizza was one of the things that we had to trim down significantly. So we kept a few recipes in the book, but that was what helped us decide, you know, our next project should probably be pizza. And I'm glad we did that because although our recipes in the bread book are solid, the world of pizza is enormous and it deserves its own set of books. That was the main reason of, you know, I mean, if you think about pizza as a food, there are more pizzerias than there are bakeries in the world. I mean, it's possibly the most popular food in the world. You can find it pretty much in every corner of the earth, where you may not find a baguette in every corner of the earth, right? I mean, it's not something people buy bread to eat with something, not necessarily to eat on its own, where pizza is a meal. And it's a convenient, portable, delicious combination of ingredients that people love in most parts of the world. So it made sense from us from many different perspectives to work to tackle the world of pizza, which is, it took 4 years. I mean, it was daunting at first because whatever we thought we knew about pizza, it was more and more and more and more. And we had to sift through so many like styles that aren't really styles, you know, so how do you define a style, right? I mean, why is, you know, Detroit pizza an actual style? And why is this new Pinza Romana not really a style? And so we had to make all of those like decisions and, you know, reason why, you know, why certain styles deserve like a solid place in our book and some just deserved a passing mention, right? So, There was a lot of that like searching and trying to understand what is pizza and what is not pizza, right? And what is an actual style and what is not a style. So.
And so do you only include pizza or do you go to other flatbreads also like La Macchina?
No, well, because that could be a rabbit hole, right? I mean, and the rabbit hole is, you know, pizza is technically a flatbread. And it is, you know, if we think about flatbreads, I mean, flatbreads, you know, from Egyptian times, you have flatbreads, right? So do we go back 5,000 years or do we decide that pizza actually, as we know it, you know, we have to think about it like you would think of like a family tree, right? You start with the youngest people and then you go back. And so for us, Neapolitan pizza was the starting point. And mostly, and you know, very simply put, is because it's the first flatbread that has sauce that they put on, right? I think that if you think of like pita and naan, yes, it's a flatbread, but I wouldn't call those a pizza. I mean, I don't think anybody would recognize those as pizza. So our starting point for pizza was Neapolitan pizza. And that's essentially, you know, that's where pizza comes from. And that's where people who emigrated from that part of the world to different parts of the world created different styles of pizza in different parts of the world. So it didn't come from China. It didn't come from Egypt. It came from Naples. And Neapolitan pizza is the mother, if you will, of all styles of pizza.
And so why is Pizza Romana not a style, but Detroit pizza is a style?
So I, just to be clear, I said pinsa, P-I-N-S-A. Oh,
okay.
Yeah. So Pizza Romana is this made up, it's one of these like marketing things that people, you know, create this story that has, it sounds like it's true. You can't really prove that it's not, but it's this style that theoretically is 2000 years old. And I'm thinking, okay, that's not even possible to know. There's no documentation of any, like most of the food that we know from 2000 years ago was from this massive undertaking from Pliny the Elder, who was a Roman who basically wrote an encyclopedia of everything that was known, including food. And so from that book, we were actually able to get some bread recipes. There's absolutely no mention of any pizza. I mean, that's absurd. And so if you look at it, if you do a search for pinsa, P-I-N-S-A, Romana, you'll see that it basically looks like an oval Neapolitan pizza. So this is marketing at play. This is somebody who just changed the shape of Neapolitan pizza, added, you know, a couple of like a little bit of soy flour, a little bit of rice flour, and it sort of looks like a Neapolitan pizza. And then they decided to call it, you know, their particular style. And that to me is we're calling BS on something like that, right? And so even though we call BS on it, we have a recipe for it in our book, but we make it very clear that we're not going to be spending a lot of time on this pizza because it's not the real deal. And we spend time on Detroit pizza. We spend time on Neapolitan, on New York, Chicago deep dish. Some people don't think it's pizza, right? But how could you not include Chicago deep dish? Something else that, you know, really isn't a pizza, but we think is the predecessor to pizza is focaccia. And so we do have a recipe for focaccia along with many variations for focaccia in the book. And we make it very clear. I mean, it's not a pizza, but focaccia, I look at focaccia and I look at Roman pizza. And I look at, you know, what people call Sicilian pizza, which we call New York Square pizza. You know, we just put sauce and cheese on it and all of a sudden it's pizza, right? But focaccia is a very old dough. Focaccia does precede Neapolitan pizza. So it does have its place in the pantheon of pizzas.
Well, how do you define, I think you kind of did define what pizza is, which is flatbread with sauce on it.
But then also no, right? Because if I think of, for example, if I think of like New Haven, like the clam pizza, it doesn't have sauce on it. I mean, it has clams, it has olive oil, it has Parmesan cheese. Optionally, some people put heavy cream on it, which I would say that's saucy-ish. Sure. It's not really a sauce. But if I look at that, I would definitely call it a pizza. In fact, we have a theory that New Haven is the closest American relative to Neapolitan style pizza. And the reason why we say this is because if you look at Neapolitan pizza in modern day, it has like the cornicione, you know, like the big fluffy crust. It has the leoparding on it. And so it's a pizza that 100 years ago you couldn't make because you didn't have the flour you have these days. You don't have the flour and that could do that in a pizza. You'd have something that would be much denser and flatter because flour was all over the place. We didn't know what we knew now about flour. So, you know, for example, Caputo, which is one of the largest makers, millers of flour for pizza in Italy. They have it down to a science now where every bag you buy is going to be consistent because they use a different mix of different grains from around Europe. They use some Italian grains, but for the most part, they bring them from Russia, Poland, Sweden, France, sometimes from Canada. And so they know what mix to do to create this flour that's going to be consistent. So it's not something you could have done 100 years ago. So it Neapolitan pizza could have been a little bit denser, a little bit flatter than it is now, just from how flour used to be. If you go to New Haven, these are, you can see a Neapolitan pizza, a New Haven pizza, and see how they're related. They have some of the blistering, some of the char marks. It's actually a little bit bigger, but that's just because those are modern tastes. But it's a little bit denser. So we could definitely see, because there was a huge immigration to New Haven of Italians. In fact, that's the term a pizza is Neapolitan dialect, right? I mean, and that is, there are many words that they utilize that are, you know, it was a very insular community. So you could see how that pizza could be very closely related to the original Neapolitan pizza. And it's kind of stayed that way, which is cool. I mean, I think that that's an interesting snippet of history right there.
Totally. So how old is Neapolitan pizza?
So there was this, like, there's this story, which is untrue, about there's a pizzeria in Naples. It's called Brandi Pizzeria, where the owner of this pizzeria claimed that they invented margarita pizza for Queen Margarita, who came to visit Naples, and so he all of a sudden concocted this like pizza with sauce and cheese. And they even have like a certificate up front, and it's fake. They're fake. But pizza can be traced to the end of the 19th century, 1870s, 1860s. We have some information of Neapolitan pizza existing, although who invented it is up in the air, mostly because it's a food of poor people, right? And so when you have food that is for poor people, it's not very well documented. It's not something that historians decided to investigate and archive and document and, you know, necessarily think about. It was a food that was eaten every day for normal people, or poor people, actually. And so you have very little documentation. There's very little photography. Even when photography existed or started to exist, there's very little documentation, photographic documentation, of what pizza used to look like. Some of the earliest pictures you're going to have is of Sophia Loren in a movie tossing pizzas. Those are some of the first images you have. She's making Neapolitan pizza. She's making fried pizza. It's very interesting from that particular perspective. And if you see what was, I mean, obviously she wasn't making them. Somebody was making them. Right. But what you see, it doesn't look 100% like Neapolitan pizzas look now. It does look flatter. It does look like a little bit more, even more rustic than Neapolitan pizza looks these days. So we can say with some certainty that the last quarter of the 19th century is when we first start to see it documented, because that is an important thing to say. It's like, that's when it was documented. Doesn't mean it didn't exist before that, but history always is like, when is the first time that something appears in written word? Where is it documented, right? And so that's where you have to start. Which more or less makes us think about, you know, when did pizza start in the United States? Well, I mean, you have this massive exodus of Neapolitans, you know, people from Campania that were basically kicked out of Campania because of cholera. So we have to thank cholera for the spreading of pizza around the world, because 1 million people from Campania had to be basically kicked out. Because they had to clean up the city. They had to redo the whole sewer system because there was a huge cholera problem. So you have people that had to go to different parts of the world, whether that was New York or Connecticut or Buenos Aires or Sao Paulo. This massive exodus is what brought pizza to different parts of the world. That's when it comes to New York, when it comes to the United States. You know, some people think that Lombardi's was the first place in that had pizza, because that's the story. That's the story, again, that keeps getting repeated. 1905, Lombardi's. In 1905, he was 17 years old. There's no way he started a pizza. The first actual documented mention of a pizzeria in New York was in 1895 it was a baker, an Italian baker, Filippo Milone, who had requested a permit for opening a forno e pizzeria. And so this was 1895. This is 10 years before Lombardi's claims that they started. But even though this is the first documented text that exists, 1895, can we really think that all of these Italians that immigrated to New York weren't making pizza before then? I mean, there's no way they waited for one guy to show up and start making pizza. It was being made, but unfortunately, the first documentation we have is 1895.
Yeah, people would have been making it in their own ovens, like people do. Yeah. Although I'm not a real food historian, but it used to be that in Europe, people would take their dough to central bakeries and it would be baked there, right?
Correct. For bread, for sure. Yes.
But not for pizza? Was that more something people
did? Not for pizza. Okay. In Naples, what you had was a lot of the original form of pizza was like these. There were, it was expensive to have an oven, first of all.
Right. Yeah.
So a lot of pizzas were made ahead of time and sold on the street. So you'd have people baking pizzas, and then there's these like crocks that, some pizzerias still have. They're like these big copper crocks. And so they would carry pizzas around and sell them on the streets. And so it's not something that you would eat fresh out of the oven. So again, that was a pretty big difference between pizza then and pizza now. Now you go and sit down, they make your pizza, you have it in 90 seconds, it's ready to go. So that's a different experience for sure. So for pizza, it was different because it was a more, it's not something that you would, bake your bread and then hold it for a week, because that is what was done with bread. It's a bread that giant loaf, it's baked, take it home, and it's the loaf of bread you have for the entire week, where pizza is a more immediate food. It doesn't have that sort of shelf life.
I see. So you'd have, were they called pizzerias then? Was that the name that was used?
We believe so. Yeah. I mean, but what an important, comment to make here is that what the term pizza is, it meant different things throughout history. And that's what stumped us for a little bit. Because the word pizza didn't always mean what you and I know as pizza now. It wasn't always like the baked dough with sauce and cheese. Initially, pizza was a term used for sweet things. And so we started to look at ancient recipes for pizza, and it had like almond flour and brown sugar and spices, and it was like baked like in a tart, and it was called a pizza. And so, we made it just out of curiosity, but it wasn't like an actual pizza, because we felt like we had hit the jackpot, right? Like this recipe from the 1600s for pizza. And it was not pizza. It was a sweet dessert that was called pizza. Eventually, there was a point in time where what we now know as pizza, it was called pizza, but it wasn't always the same term used for it. Some people used to call it a focaccia. Focaccia meant everything that was flat and baked. So there's even like sweet focaccias. And so the terminology is what gets confusing, and understanding what people meant by it is also very important for understanding the history behind it.
Well, so what is the difference between focaccia as we know it now and pizza? I mean, to me, it's like the bread is different. The crust is different.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and it really depends on what part of history you're looking at, because focaccia could have been round and very flat. Focaccia, as you see it today, is a little bit thicker. It's more bread-like. Mm-hmm. It's something that could be served cold. It's not something that needs to be served hot, where pizza is something that people more commonly have hot, more commonly will put stuff on top of it. If I think of focaccia, I think of it as a bread that is baked in a pan, whether flat or round, and very simply garnished. Salt, olive oil, rosemary, thyme, that's it. Some places will put, garlic cloves on it. Some places will put grapes, which has always seemed a little bit weird to me, but it is what it is, or tomatoes. But it's very simply garnished. It's something that is, it's almost like if you made a bread with inclusions, that's more or less what it would be. But it's meant, a focaccia is meant to accompany a meal, where pizza is a meal.
Right. So in the U.S., for some reason, often preceded by wings. I don't know why, but wings are the most popular appetizer to have with pizza.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I mean, that is interesting. And I wonder what that, why that is. I mean, it's food you eat with your hands, I suppose, but
yeah,
I don't see the connection.
And why do you eat both? Like, pizza is a full meal, so I don't know why you would need to have wings with it, but the appetite.
I know, right? Yeah, I don't, I mean, I could see it, for example, like if you've, I don't know how many times you've had Chicago deep dish, but when you go and have Chicago deep dish, it's a, you have to allot a certain amount of time because of the time it takes to bake pizza.
Right.
So I can see ordering food before you get your pizza, because it's like a 40-minute wait.
Right.
To get your pizza. So I wonder if you're still even hungry by the time you get your pizza. If you order out, I don't know. It's something I really wondered. Pizza is a fast food, right? It's something that you get quickly, you eat it, you're out. If you have to wait 40 minutes for anything, I mean, imagine a lunch where you had to allot an hour just to get your pizza. So this is something that I've thought about, but you know, it is what it is, and it exists. And some people spend that much time waiting for a pizza to be baked. So,
right. And if you were to say that Chicago pizza is not pizza, you would have a war. So
yes, for sure.
Oh, fine. I mean, I personally think that whatever they are, they're all the pizzas are good, but
right.
Maybe we need different names, because, for example, a New York style pizza is very different from a Chicago style pizza. I think if
absolutely
a neutral person, a person who had never seen pizza, would not be able to tell you what they have in common, except tomato sauce, I guess, and cheese.
Correct. But you know, something that is interesting too, somebody who's born and bred in the United States, they're accustomed to, I would say, mostly what is New York style. That's like the most common, right?
Right.
And if they've never tasted Neapolitan pizza, and you put a Neapolitan pizza in front of it, most of the time they won't like it because it's so different, right? It's not crusty. It's soft. It's limp. You have to eat it. The cheese doesn't brown. It just melts. So it's even though they're both recognizable as pizza, they couldn't be more different. And then you have Chicago deep dish. And yes, it's a different experience. Some people will say they call it a pizza casserole. But it's one of those things, like, how could we not include it in the book, right?
Right, absolutely. So are there, so you have Detroit style, are there other major, and New Haven style, are there other major types of American pizza that you shine a light on in your book?
You know, there's for example, there's many pizzas in the United States that are thin crust, and some people call it Chicago thin crust. Some people call it tavern pizza. And so it's, you look at these pizzas, they look very similar to each other. So what we decided was to kind of group them all into a thin crust category. So that is, you know, and in there you could put Chicago thin crust and you could put, you know, tavern pizza in there. But a style that has been, you know, I guess emerging since the 80s, with Alice Waters and Wolfgang Puck, which some people would call California style, but it's kind of spread around the country to like Chris Bianco in Phoenix, to in New Jersey you have Rasa with which is a fantastic pizza, but those don't look to me like New York style pizza. What we decided was to call this category of pizza artisan pizza. Because it's a smaller pizza, it has more of a bready look to it, it's crustier, it's a dough that has more thought that goes into it, so you have the more open crumb on the crust, and then you have very like chef-y toppings on that, you know, so it's not like sauce and cheese only, it's organic local produce, it's these like artisan cheeses that go on top of it, all these different cured meats. You know, there's a lot of thought that goes into the process itself. Not that there isn't in New York, but these are more, I would say, like chef-driven sort of pizza, right? If you think of Wolfgang Puck's salmon and caviar pizza, that's very highbrow, right? It's not something you would get on the street in New York City for, you know, a dollar slice. Right. So you could definitely see a distinction between those two styles of pizza. There's Quad Cities, too, which Quad Cities is a it's in Illinois, and it's this corner where, you know, four counties kind of converge, And it's a, you know, theoretically, it's a style in which the dough has, they add a little bit of like malt syrup to it, so it browns more when it bakes. The sauce is theoretically a little bit spicier than, it's a tomato sauce, but it's spicier. So it's sauce, and then they put this layer of like pork sausage on top of it, and then the cheese goes on top. And it's very strangely cut. It's cut into, it's a round pizza, but it's cut into rectangular, like cut down the center, and then rectangular strips. So every slice is different, which I have a hard time understanding why anybody would want to do that, because every slice is different. So what slice do you get? So anyway, it's almost like, you know, all of these like Chicago thin crust that's cut into squares. Why do we cut pizza into squares? Like a round pizza into squares? I mean, that's, it's, if it were for a children's party, I would say yes. But if we're all adults, why are we eating tiny squares of pizza? So anyway. And so that those would be like the major categories of what American style pizzas are. And you'll see, you know, we think that the United States has the most variety of styles of pizza than pretty much anywhere in the world. I mean, that's, it's a very interesting phenomenon to see what we've done here with just the simple combination of dough, sauce, and cheese.
Yeah, I remember years ago I was at a pizza competition. And it's this chef from Ohio who put ranch dressing as the main sauce for the pizza and then put on grilled chicken and caramelized onions. And I thought, you're a barbarian. But it was so it was just a scrumptious pizza. And I ate the pizza as well as my words, because it was really
good. I mean, that's the thing, is that there's so many possibilities of what can go onto a pizza that, you know, margarita and marinara are fine, and they are the most popular toppings. I mean, it's almost like vanilla ice cream and chocolate ice cream. I mean, these are ubiquitous. And those are the pizzas that every pizzeria that we visited, because we've visited over 200 pizzerias around the world, we always ask them to prepare those two pizzas for us, because it really is the ruler by which a pizzaiolo measures him or herself. Is these two pizzas, right? And really it is how others will basically judge them, on the quality of these two pizzas. So then we would order those two plus whatever they wanted to showcase, like what represents them the best. So I think I've become numb now to margarita and marinara, mostly because I've had so many that they are actually right now my least favorite style. I need to let a few years go by before I can like fully appreciate them again. But it's the most ubiquitous topping. As you start to move into other toppings, and depending on, you know, who the pizzaiolo is, where they have like a culinary, like cooking training background. Sometimes they have like a bread baking background. And you can tell the difference in their product when they have different backgrounds that are not strictly a pizzaiolo background.
Wow. And so how many volumes is this? Is Modernist Pizza?
Modernist Pizza is three volumes. It's three volumes and a kitchen manual. The kitchen manual is basically a spiral bound compilation of all the recipes that is smaller and portable, and you can bring it into your kitchen. And the paper is like plastified, so that if you get any tomato sauce or oil on it, it will easily wipe off. Right. So that you don't bring your beautiful three volume book into the kitchen. You know, the kitchen manual serves that purpose. So,
and if you're doing it right, you definitely are going to get oil and sauce on the manual.
I'd be surprised if you didn't. So, for sure.
Well, Francisco Magoya, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. Congratulations on your new book.
It's always a pleasure. Always.
Likewise, and now I'm looking forward to your baking book, whenever that
happens. Yes, I'll see you in 4 years, or five, maybe, right. We'll see.
I hope before then. Take your time, eat some vegetables.
Yes, for sure.